it's pretty good. I'm money, honestly, but.
It's sad, I apologize to you guys, you know, it's, he said he sent an email to me 6 o'clock this morning. He sounded really bad, he's.
John?
Yeah, he sounded like he's really, really sick, but.
The kid carries you.
Now without a quorum, I guess we can go ahead and just still have the meeting, we just can't pass anything.
Can't vote on anything.
Can't vote on anything.
Still go through, huh?
All right, it is 9:10 in the morning. February 19th, 2018. This, meeting was posted, the meeting for today, 2/19/18, was posted on February the 2nd, 2018 at 8:29 a.m. by Jessica. I'm calling to order the meeting of the City of Ocala Firefighters Pension Fund at 9:10 in the morning, February 19th. Roll call, Jim Williams is absent, John Dozier is absent, Larry Fagan is absent. Present are Randy Griffin and Justin Hardy. Others in attendance are Dave West, David Harris, Robert Davis, Josh Wilson, I mean Josh Phillips, Scott Bolton, Alicia Gaither, and Jessica Feller. All right, I have, also, for the record, we do not have a quorum. We're going to go ahead with the meeting, but we will not be able to take any action today. So we're going to go ahead with the actuarial report and the quarterly report. And unfortunately, we will not be able to take any action. With that said, I'm going to turn the floor over to David Harris to do the presentation of the actuarial report.
Okay. Well, glad to be here today to go over the actuarial report. I've given everybody actually three documents. The one in red is the actual draft of your evaluation report. It says draft on all the pages, so that's we do it that way because we know it's not finalized until it's formally approved by the board, which doesn't sound like it won't happen today. But that's fine. That's not a requirement. The other piece of information, just to know you, it's about an 8-page document. It's just about your COLA fund, talking about
this one.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
Yes. Just talking about the increase to the COLA table for 2000, starting January 1, 2018. And then the third and final document, which is the one I really go over, is this one here in black. It says it's the board summary. So this takes everything that we're required to put in the actuarial evaluation report and summarize it into what's really important to everybody. So that's the one we'll go through. So if you want to start with that one and go over to page two, this is just kind of a highlight of the year. Some things that are important to note, funded ratio went up, it's now about 78%, so it went from 75 to 78%. That's the results of a good market return, which translated into a good, better than expected actuarial return as well. We smooth assets so that we don't recognize all the good market return all the same year it happened. We smooth it out over 5 years. Same thing we do for losses as well. So we've had some good market value returns over the last few years. So our actuarial value now is actually a little bit less than market value. It's about 1% less. So there's a little bit of more good news out into the future that we'll capture. Which hasn't been there previously. If you look at your actuarial value of assets, you'll notice that it's about $49 million.
Can I stop you for one second? So that funded ratio is, that's an honest, honest funded ratio using a legitimately honest discount rate at the 7.5%?
Yes.
Compared to other systems that might be using higher discount rate assumptions and will look like their funded status is
might
higher.
Be funded, yeah, might look like their funded status.
It's just important to
yeah,
it is, because for instance, the police plan, I think they have 7.75% assumption rate. I believe it is, and they're, I think, I forget what their funded rate
is. Yeah, they're working their way down. They're working each year.
Gradually. And we'll see some comparisons to the other plans in the state of Florida further slide.
Now, when they talk funded ratio, I see so many different funded ratios throughout the actuarial report. Which one is the one that they like for the GASB and all that?
Yeah.
Is this the one that do they look at the market value or the actuarial value?
Probably depends on who you're talking to.
Okay.
If you're probably talking to the city, they're looking at the GASB one.
Okay.
The GASB one actually will look much better.
Right.
Because it's based on market value of assets.
Okay.
And really what they're looking at is they're looking at not only this plan, but they're also looking at the money that's in the drop.
Right.
And they're also looking at the money you have in the COLA as well.
Okay.
So they're looking at all that. We have liabilities built in for that as well. But generally, especially with the drop, the liability is the account, so it's 100% funded. So when you add that in and do a comparison, you're only improving your funded ratio in the process. So especially in this case where, as for right now, your actuarial value is a little bit less than your market value, you're actually picking up a percentage of showing the market value, and then you're picking up 100% of the additional liability you're bringing in for the drop and really for the COLA as well. That amounts to about, there's about $8 million total that you have in drop accounts and reserve for the COLA. That's really on a GASB basis would be making your funded ratio look even better than the 78%. So that's what the financial people would look at. The actuaries, like myself, just look at the fund.
Right.
Because we know for this fund, we're trying to get to 100% funded. That's the ultimate goal of any pension plan, is to be sure that the assets are there to pay off the benefits.
Okay.
And so those are the numbers we look at. A 75% up to a 78% over the course of 1 year is very, very strong.
Yeah.
To do that without doing any manipulation like, hey, we're going to raise our interest rate up to 8%,
right.
Therefore we're going to, play some games, make our funded ratio look better. You've actually lowered your discount rate. You lowered it last year from 7.75 down to 7.5. And then with your negotiations you put through and how you're using some of the state reserve money to help pull down your unfunded liability, it's actually helping. So it's a very strong move for the year to go up.
Okay.
Addition to that, at the bottom of what the total contribution is for the year, last year it was about $2.5 million, now it's $2.4. It's actually down about $75,000 for what the city has to put in, and that's even after the negotiation that they're no longer be able to use $240,000 of the state reserve, only using $200,000 of that state reserve. So
right.
Even with that, basically give back to the firefighters of that $40,000, the city contribution is still going down about $75,000.
Okay.
So that's good news for the city that with the strong market value and everything else, that their costs are actually decreasing.
Can I ask one more?
Yes.
Can you, I guess, bring forward the, every year we talk about the normal cost as a percentage versus the, how many cents on the dollar the sponsor contribution, what that represents, like the normal cost is very small here in comparison to the unfunded.
Yeah, for here you've got two things going on with the pension plan. You're paying for benefits that people are earning over the next year. That's your normal cost. So that's what you're paying because people are still in the system. They've worked an extra year. They've gotten maybe a pay increase. And so you're funding for those extra benefits that are doing, and you're doing that on an annual basis. And then the other components of what you pay on an annual basis is you've got this unfunded liability. Much like a house mortgage, you're trying to pay it off. So we're trying to pay that down over a period of years. In this plan, you know, over 20 years to get it back to 100% funded. So you've got those two components going into play. And so you can see for this plan, the total normal cost is about $1.2 million. So that's the total cost of the benefits that you're funding for the firefighters for the next year, of which about $520,000 of it is being paid by firefighter contributions. You get money taken out of your paycheck because of the contributions going in to support that. And so you've got net to the city. The city's basically paying $700,000. So they're paying a little bit more than half of the benefits, but it's a pretty close to a 50-50 split. The other component is this past service cost. That's the pay down of the unfunded liability. And so you can see that we've got about $1.6, $1.7 million of paying down that unfunded liability. So that makes up about two-thirds of the overall cost of the plan.
In your conference, at the conference we went to, the PPTA conference when you were there?
Yes.
You mentioned about the different types of that smoothing where the how you smooth it, some of it is an open-ended or some of it's like a closed, like mm-hmm. which is our
you're using closed. Okay. So these things, well, if everything goes according to plan, you don't create any more unfunded liability for various things that can happen.
Right.
That number disappears.
Right.
After 20 years,
and most government agencies do the other type from what I understood in the conference.
A lot of them use an open right. method to try to,
which is essentially just starting over every year.
Which is basically refinancing a house every year, so you never pay off your house.
Right.
So
at least this is actually this is actually far better, far healthier for our
yes.
fund in the long run. Okay.
Yeah, we would call it conservative, and in our terminology, conservative means you're putting more money into the plan.
Right.
So that's okay. That's how we would consider it. But you can see that the majority of the cost, you know, you're paying about 34% of payroll. The city's paying about 34% of payroll. Two-thirds of that is the unfunded liability, which, you know, will eventually go away. So in essence, really, 10% of payroll costs is really for the benefits of the plan that are accruing, which is great, and that's something that oftentimes gets overlooked when the city starts saying, hey, you know, we've got a 34% of payroll. This is just, it's extreme. It's too much. It's unsupportable. And that's where we always recommend boards need to go back and say, no, really, our benefits themselves, you're only paying 10%. You know, for the benefits, we ourselves for our contributions are paying, you know, 7-8% for the benefit as well. So it's a fairly well. It's we just got this unfunded liability that's grown over the years, that's causing all this. You know, so it makes it look very high, but that eventually disappears.
So the unfunded liability. We're not adding more unfunded liability on a yearly basis then? This is if everything stays the same.
If everything
stays the same. They'll eventually be paid off, but inevitably every year there's some kind of an unfunded liability that will also have to be mortgaged out, right? So we're always have that little window of things that are being smoothed out over time.
It could grow, it could decrease. Okay. This year it actually decreased. The experience under the plan, and we'll touch that on another slide, actually, there were some things where the liability didn't grow as much as we expected it to,
right.
And your assets grew better than we expected them to, and so all that helps reduce the unfunded liability, so you basically get a credit for that,
okay.
And that reduces what you're having to pay off over the year. So that's the ultimate goal, is using some of this state money as well to help drive down that unfunded even on a faster basis.
But your point's right. So whether, if you meet all, it would stay the same?
Yeah.
As long as you met all of the assumptions? You know, everything came in exactly as assumed, then it wouldn't change. And then another, I think another related thing here, that they pointed out, you're amortizing over 20 years, right?
Yes.
There's some things that are amortized over 5 years.
Yeah. It depends on what it is. If it's something like for somebody who's just about to retire,
right.
you can't amortize that over a long period because they're 2 years to retirement.
So that's
if
a shorter
it's a new employee and you're getting a benefit, you've got many years to pay for that benefit. So those typically are amortized over longer periods. So it depends on what type of event it is.
And they're basically itemized by each year that it happens too, correct?
Yes.
And so that's contained in this little bubble over here from 2016 or whatever, and the next year has its own essentially set of numbers.
Yes. And in the full actuarial report, you can actually see all the bases that have been set up.
You can see
how much they were originally, how much time's left on them,
right.
And how much is being paid to pay them off.
Right.
I just wanted to bring out that, you know,
I'm trying to learn.
That's why Dave's bringing up what he's bringing, and Dave is going into the details. And you guys
with my
so if this makes the 7.5, which is our number, right? Isn't that what the number needs? We need 7.5.
Correct.
Okay, so if it makes that, then we're meeting all our goals. So our unfunded liability technically shouldn't change. Unless late, maybe the mortality table changes again. We use that, right?
Yeah, hopefully. I mean, the mortality table, there's a possibility.
It is about to change.
State changes.
What I understand.
Change. It shouldn't be as impactful as it has been in the past.
Right.
It really wasn't all that impactful for your plan because you were using something that was pretty close to what they were doing, so you didn't have as big of an impact as other plans that I've seen. And most of the plans going forward, most of the mortality adjustments won't have as large of an impact as it could potentially have previously.
So things that will affect the unfunded liability, would that be like disability?
It could.
People leaving employment early, maybe?
It's people leaving different than we expect them to.
Okay.
So a person retiring early generally creates additional liability into the plan because you're paying them off earlier. And some people would argue, well, if they had left later, they would have had more service and more pay and their benefit would have been larger. And that's generally true, but the fact that you're paying them earlier, even though it's a smaller benefit, is generally more expensive to the plan than allowing them to accrue those extra benefits and not having to pay them for, you know, another 2 or 3 years in the plan.
And I believe our assumption is they're going to work 5 years past the rule of 70.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, because that's what it almost does.
So we know what your
goes out the day they're going to retire. Almost everybody works many years after their eligibility, and we assume they're going to work 5 years past their eligibility according to the rule of 70.
And what about outliving the mortality table?
There's people that are under. I mean, about
there's people that,
that's
there's people
that
don't.
That's why the table's created, correct?
The best we can do is guess when a person's going to die.
Right.
But you know, we don't know that.
You're going to have those that live to 90, and you're going to have the Kathy Penn, you know, who only collect for 3 or 4 years. And
so it probably averages itself out.
And one of the things, and really we don't do much with the mortality table now since it's dictated by legislation and by the state, but generally part of an experience study that we would do, and later in this presentation we're recommending that y'all do it, it's time to do another one. We would look at the mortality table and see whether there's things that, you know, potentially would need to be adjusted. Some people in the past have said, we're public safety.
We die earlier,
and that's really not the case. It was always the presumption that's what it was, but in general, firefighters and police officers are healthier because of the nature of their business, and as long as they don't suffer an on-the-job related injury or something like that, once they get to retirement, they're generally healthier than the general population. and, you know, they had better health habits and things like that in their career just because they had to. And they generally tend to live at least as long, if not longer, than the other population. So there was actually a study that was done by CalPERS probably 5 years ago, which gave credence to that their public safety analysis was they were actually living longer than, you know, about half a year to a year. So not a tremendous amount, but still it was evidence there that they were healthier and living longer than the general public.
Okay. One thing I wanted to bring up with the amortization schedule, because it's a big FPPTA talk item.
Yes.
Is that since you guys are using a 20-year schedule, that's pretty conservative. So you're paying off your unfunded over 20 years. Most systems out there, from what we see anyway, sitting and listening to the reports and through, you know, the FPPTA ed stuff. Most systems had to negotiate down to 25 years from 30. Does the state still allow 20 years?
The state law requires 30 years. So they're saying if you're going to amortize, you can amortize everything over 30 years. That's the longest
period. It's basically like buying a house with a 30-year mortgage. You're essentially renting a house. You don't need equity for the first 15 years of the mortgage. So it's essentially the same thing when you're amortizing out your unfunded liability for 30 years, not even making a dent in it, really, for 30 years.
You're just taking the can.
Most people don't realize that the value of the house and amortize, you haven't paid off 80% of your house until about 26 years out.
That's right. By having the 20-year, I totally get it. That makes your little line that you had. Remember, you had the wavy line, your little straight line. But I totally get it. That's a very healthy way of amortizing out our unfunded liability. Very, very healthy, from what I can see.
Yeah. It's consistent with the history of conservative practices here that have kept you guys really stable.
Nice.
On a 30-year mortgage at 23 years, you've paid 50% of your mortgage off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We'll just look at your mortgage payment.
Yeah.
It's three-fourths interest for the first, 10 years.
Oh, yeah.
Well, when the organization starts to see the total cost from 20 to 32.
So that shows the conservatism in our plan and the hope of how they're...
Same thing.
Because all these things are all stacked. Okay. Essentially, you know, by having the closed amortization where it actually goes away and it's not just passed on, and we're not in a situation like Illinois.
And 50% of our 175 fund goes to pay down the unfunded liability. The city can't use it for their normal costs.
50% of the 175 money?
Has to go to pay down the unfunded liability.
And that was that $200,000 number, right?
Well, the $200,000 is what they get to use. You brought the state money that came in was about $434,000.
Yeah.
So $200,000. The city gets to use to help offset its contribution.
Their normal cost.
Yeah, their normal cost.
Use the normal cost.
And then the other $230,000 in this situation, half of it goes to the COLA fund.
Right.
And then the other half goes to pull down the unfunded liability. So you're getting over $100,000 a year, which is going directly into paying down this $14 million of unfunded liability. So it's putting a dent into it much faster.
Is it the 1235 normal cost? That's the city's contribution.
Okay. The 1235 is the cost of benefits that would be funded over the next year. So that's kind of what you're funding for the benefits. Totally, that's what the benefits are growing.
Past service cost, is that the liability?
That's the liability. So that $14 million, 14.26 unfunded liability, the third number down.
Yeah.
You're trying to pay that off, and right now you'd be paying $1.6 million to help eat into that $14 million unfunded to pull that number down.
Gotcha.
If you go over to page 3, this is just how the funding requirement has been as a percentage of payroll, just kind of historically. When it starts to grow, this is when everybody had poor asset returns. you know, and so it really drove up what dragged the payoff, because everybody's unfunded liability grew tremendously during that period of time, because they lost, you know, 10 or 20% of their asset value, and they're trying to make that back up through amortization. So that part tended to grow, so it stayed pretty steady there. In 2012, 2013, you lowered your discount rate, and so the number sitting there for 13, 14 is 32.2. It would have been 28.9. So you can see that, you know, just lowering your discount rate increased the amount of money that needed to be funded into the plan, which is typical. And then the same thing happened in 2017, 2018, where we went from 7.75 down to a 7.5. And in addition to that, you had the mortality table change as well. So you would expect that this number would probably start drifting back down. Every time you get down to about 28-29%, it seems like something happens to push it back up, either through design of lowering your discount rate, which is not a bad thing to do, or some mortality table changes and things like that, which increase it back up.
Do you have charts in here that break down that break that down, like we were just talking about?
I could create one. I don't have one in here that breaks it down to that, but I could to see how much of it is unfunded liability versus everything else. So.
Because and I'm sorry, I didn't mean to beat this to death, but it's just for people outside this room that don't understand the complex. I mean, this is super complex. For people that outside the room that don't understand, we've been trying to, this is an FPCPA thing, right, to try and help everyone communicate with their elected officials. And, you know, to your point, a lot of people are just looking at, this total number as a percent of pay, and it looks high, but when you break it down, you know, members are taking a chunk of that responsibility. And the normal cost is, David pointed out, it's like 10 cents on the dollar, right, for every dollar of city contribution. So, you know, the...
Is there a simple place to see that, 10 cents on the dollar in this?
I could break that down for you, though. So I could take this chart and basically show of this amount how much is your paying off trying to find a liability, how much is the city paying for the annual cost of benefits, how much is the employee paying for the annual cost of benefits, and you'll see through this chart, I don't have it here, but I know what it's going to look like. You'll see about two-thirds of that is going to be the unfunded liability bar of saying, well, once this goes away, you really see that your expected cost of benefits is very stable and very level, and in this case, probably very small in comparison to what they're having to pay. And it's all the fact that you're just having to pay off the unfunded liability.
It's like, that's such a huge visual.
Yeah.
The uninformed deal with that.
Absolutely. And then they talk to the fellow firemen in the station that, you know, part of our job as firemen on the board, I think it's state designed that way, is because we go back to the fire station and we talk about this with the members. They don't understand it. They look to us to educate them about, so we have to educate ourselves, and then go back to the fire station and then have to be able to show them, you know, in simple terms, what's going on with their money.
Sorry.
Yeah. Oh, no problem.
No, this is good for me. All of us. This is great.
You said, yeah, just wait till your presentation.
I'm taking some notes here. The next page, page four, is talking about the plan experience. This kind of goes back of how the unfunded liability changed from last year to this year. And you can see that we expected it to go down about $300,000, so we knew you were paying some of it off, so we were expecting it to go down. You actually had, I'll call it good demographic experience. People die. Depending on what side of the table you're on, you can look at it different ways. You'll see on the next chart. But good demographic experience, meaning not as much liability was created as we expected. And that's good for the plan. It lowers the liability in the plan. It may not necessarily be good for the membership because there are things that go into it that play into that, and I'll go into that. And then the asset experience, as I said, you had good asset return. The actuarial value return was greater than what was expected, which was 7.5%, and so that helped drive down the unfunded liability as well. The one thing down at the bottom I'll just make note of, the assumption change, you'll notice that there really was no assumption change that affected the unfunded liability. There was something we had to do under state law, which increased the contribution. Unlike when you pay off a house, you get your amortization set up on your house just as a level dollar amount. So whether it's now or whether it's 30 years from now, you're paying the same dollar amount. For pension plans, you get to do it as a percentage of pay. So you end up paying the same percentage of pay each year towards your unfunded liability. So as your pay or as your payroll increases, your dollar amount is kind of increasing over time, but as a percentage of pay, it's staying level. Now the state says you're fine doing that, but you're not allowed to use something that's greater than a 10-year average of what your payroll growth has been.
This payroll, is it just the plan's payroll, or
it's the
entire
fire department. Yeah, and really, for our purposes, it's the non-drop payroll. So another important thing to note about pension plans is once you go into the drop from an actuarial perspective, you're retired.
You're allowed. So
even though you still have payroll, you're still on the job, you're still getting paid.
You're not contributing to the plan.
It's not part of the normal cost of the plan or anything along that. You're just a retiree, and your movement from kind of drop/retiree status is the only thing that's affecting that. So these numbers are all based on non-drop payroll. So they can be influenced somewhat if you have a lot of people 1 year to the next all of a sudden go into the drop. You had 4 people go into the drop this past year, which kind of drove your funding payroll down a little bit because just the number of people that went in. And so that's not numbers, that's not the payroll we generally look at. But the state says we look at your 10-year payroll growth as firefighters, and we'll take that average, and we will assume that that will be the payroll growth going out into the future. So that's what we're going to allow you to do your amortization over. So in this case, just based on the 10-year average growth, we had to drop that number down. It really wasn't all that high to begin with. It was 1.9%. But we had to drop it down to 1.49%, just because
the state said
it's 10 year and we drop off year and we have to add a year. And next year it might even be, it might have to go down again, just because.
Look at the, after 08, we had so many years of no payroll growth.
Yes. Well, and actually, your 10th year back shows a 17% payroll growth, and that number is going to drop off.
Okay.
So if I drop a 17% off, and if I don't add a 17% back, it's going to go down.
A little bit of payroll growth, that'd be, our contract was going to basically increase the payroll for this year, so that'll.
But not.
It won't be as high, but it'll be somewhere.
It'll be somewhat high. It won't completely replace the 17%. So that number may. It'll soften the blow a little bit, but it'll still go up somewhat. So that's the only thing. Just to note, that's one of the many complexities of funding a plan that has to be looked at as we go through this. But just to make note of that. And still, once again, the contribution, 2.545 last year, 2.471 this year. So even with that, and that was a $75,000 increase to the contribution as well. So even with all these things that are negatively affecting what the city had to put in, they lost $40,000 from state funding. The $75,000 got added into it. And even with all that, the other experience helped drive their overall contribution down $75,000.
Right. And even at $40,000, $20,000 of that goes to pay down the unfunded liability, so it's not like they're even losing that.
True.
They're actually gaining.
That's still helping their cause, correct?
So they come out ahead about $75,000.
Yeah. On page five, this is where we talk about all the things that could potentially happen at a pension plan which can affect your cost. So retirements, we show five actual retirements. I think four of those were people that went into the draw. One of those was a person who actually retired. We only expected, our assumptions only expected one to go through.
I don't remember.
I'd have to look to see who the one person is.
I don't know if he retired after October 1st or before. He retired in November, so he's going to be on next year to somebody else. Okay.
But you see that more people retired than we expected, and that increased your liability. So once again, goes back to that point that more people retiring earlier causes an increase in the liability. Turnover, this was a little bit unusual for this year. Normally, if you have more turnover, that's a benefit to the plan because you're taking a lot of future liabilities not having to pay, and it's just kind of gone because you're not having to pay anybody for those. So people who leave the system early on in their careers actually is a benefit to the system because you're
like Mike,
not having to pay them.
And then their money, their contribution to main interest, which stays in the plan.
And the city's contribution stays in the
plan. The city was planning on funding for them. Now they don't have to, but that money's already in the plan. So that's typically a benefit. I think this was the case. The reason it raised liability a little bit, I think, was just probably the nature of who it was who left.
New guys, if new people.
So people who are not vested, if they leave, it's actually a positive for the plan.
Yes.
If the less time they have on, the less impact it has. If they have on like 8, 7, 8, 9 years, it has a big impact.
So they're like 9 years and 11 months, and then their money made over those years stays in. So that's a big plus.
Yeah, the third one down, mortality, you look at that completely different way. It's kind of morbid for us to look at it, but greater than expected mortality is good for a plan. If you want to save the plan money, get your people to die. because you're no longer paying them, and you were expecting to be paying them out into the future, so that's why there's a savings there. And for disability, a little bit of savings because no one disabled over the course of the year. Disability is a valuable benefit in the public safety world, so the fact that no one took advantage of it, fortunately no one had to take advantage of it, but the fact that no one had to ends up being a benefit to the plan as well because you're not paying out that benefit that you're expected to. The big thing here is salaries, and you mentioned things that have an impact on the salaries. We have to make an assumption about how people's salaries are going to grow through their career and do that if they don't meet those expectations. If salaries are less than expected, that means benefits are less than expected. And that means you don't have to fund as much into the plan. That becomes a savings to the plan. So here, and we looked at just continuing active, so what their pay was last year versus what their pay was this year, and it showed a very marginal increase for this year versus what we would on average expect the salaries to go up by.
So it's actually better for the plan if your pay stays without increase?
It's better for the plan if pays stay below expectations. So if you had if we knew that your plan was not going to have any pay increases out into the future, we would change our assumption to say we're not going to expect any pay increases out into the future. So right now we're saying, on average, I think with inflation, a little bit of merit, You know, we're expecting on average the pays to go up about 5% a year, on average. So we know that there's going to be a mixture of some of the younger guys who are...
So if it doesn't meet that expectation, it's actually better for the plan. If it exceeds it, it's negative towards the plan.
Yes.
Even though the percentage that comes out of the pay is proportionally increasing, it's still based on the assumption of what it's going to be.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, and that's based on the fact that you're only paying a portion of your benefit.
Right.
So as you know, on the previous pages, you're paying, the member is paying, you know, 40 to 50% of the benefit. And so if the benefit's not where it's expected to be, then that ends up being a savings to the plan.
Okay. Now, Rob just negotiated our contract and we just voted on it last year. So we will be getting, what do you say, between 4 and 5% over the next 3 years?
It passed.
Yeah, it pretty much guaranteed to be sitting around 4, could go up to 5, but there's some people that will be dropping off to fulfill the total amount of money in the plan, you know, that retire, you know, so they don't see in that 4%.
Sure.
But there's, so.
Yeah, and when we do our next experience study, that'll be one of the things we look at is long-term, what the expectation is, and as well as what do you negotiate?
Right.
Because that could come into play, saying, well, maybe for the near term, we need to assume something else, but for the long term, you know, we do something different.
It's fine for now. It's over, so currently.
Yeah, so we'll be able to factor that into our next study. So if you knew that you were getting
10,
if you knew you were getting 10, then we would factor in the 10, and that way you wouldn't necessarily see a large gain or a loss in the plan because we've already assumed that that was going to occur. Otherwise, if we maintained a 5% and you knew you were getting 10%, then I could sit here and tell you, okay, you're going to have a loss to the plan because your benefits are much larger than what we expected them to be because your pay was a lot larger than we expected.
And that's based on a year, right? 5.23?
Yes, that's based on a year. That's actually taking everybody's age according to the salary scale we've assumed for everybody and kind of matching them up and saying we expected this person's pay to grow from this to this. And then just compared to how it did. So you can see that the salary increase not being as great as we expected, that was the largest driver of a demographic savings to the plan. And then once again, the assets, since it returned greater than 7.5%, that's an additional savings. So almost $900,000 that reduced your unfunded liability just through demographics and asset experience that occurred through the course of the plan. So having nothing to do with additional monies that got contributed to the plan, negotiated money, the state revenue is going in, that's completely separate from this number. So that would just be an addition onto that. Page 6, it's just a comparison, just kind of the market value and actuarial value of assets. I mentioned that, you know, an actuarial value of assets just smooths out the gains and losses over about 5 years. So you, or more specifically, the city doesn't see its contributions fluctuate up and down as greatly with the market. Once again, that's something important to discuss with the city, or at least remind the city of when they go, well, we had these great asset returns this past year. Why didn't our contribution drop as much as we expected it to? And it's because we're not recognizing all those gains in 1 year. We're recognizing them over 5 years. So you're going to see that increase recognized over the next 5 years as opposed to 1 year. And if you have a downturn in the market, the same thing you said is like, well, your contribution didn't go up as much as you probably expected it to because, once again, we're recognizing those losses over 5 years. We're not recognizing immediately. So it helps them better plan and budget for what the contribution is going to be because they're not going to see large swings up and down. As they will when they look at the financial reports, well, those are financial reports are strictly on GASB, which is done strictly on market value. They will see large fluctuations in that, one, because they're looking at it strictly on a market value, and two, the components of kind of the unfunded liability and how they get recognized. They get recognized over a much shorter period of time in GASB, probably about 5 to 7 years, as opposed to the 15 or 25 years that we get to do it for funding purposes. So that's another reason that it's hard to compare the two now as it used to be. And then once again, depending on what they're looking at, you know, sometimes you might be in the mindset of what the funding is, and the person you're talking to might be looking at the GASB report and saying, well, I'm seeing completely different numbers here. So what, and you just have to make sure you're on the same page of what you're talking about. But you can see on page six, you know, market value has been relatively strong the last 5 years, other than the fiscal year ending 2015, which was kind of flat or slightly down market for everybody. But for the most part, it's been very, very strong. An important number to kind of look at is the historical rates of return. Historically, over the 20 years in the plan, you know, the market value has been about 5.6%, which is, you know, not at the 7.5% that you're expecting. So that's just something to kind of keep an eye on, that historically that number has been relatively low. It means that you've been fairly conservatively invested. It's not necessarily a bad thing, because it means you haven't had the huge upturns and downturns that a lot of other plans have probably had during some of the tumultuous times. And really, even in the past 5 years, even with that, you've probably captured the majority of what other people have been seeing in the market rate return. So you've been doing pretty well.
And that 10-year number, I think that negative 19.2 is going to drop off next
yes.
year.
Yes, yeah, so there is some...
will look much better.
Good big help
next yeah. year. Everybody's looking forward to next year's report because of that. Page seven is a number I like to put in here. It just helps track the benefit payments, because that's the whole purpose of this plan, is to pay out benefit payments. And it indicates, what I like to look at is what are you paying out as a percentage of your assets? You know your assets are expected to return 7.5%. So if you're having to pay out less than 7.5% of your assets in benefit payments, that means some of that extra return is just going towards additional benefits, improving your funded status. It means you're not expecting your asset base to drop down and continue to diminish. You're expecting this one to continue to grow. And then on page eight, this is just kind of projection. We included it for the first time last year, I think. Larry Fagan asked for this, but just seeing a projection of kind of what the plan is. Just kind of a long-range view of where you stand now in terms of number of participants and how much in benefit payments you're going to be making, you know, versus now and out in the future. You can see that now the blue line showing the number of participants, you've got about 90 people who are actively getting benefit payments, and 20 years from now that number will grow. With those people still receiving it, and new people coming in, new people going in and dropping and retiring, that number will be about 150 people. I guess you could say a pretty significant increase from 90 to 150 people that are receiving it. In terms of the benefit payments will be paid out, it's going to go from, you know, we're expecting it to be around a little over $3 million now, it'll be about $8 million 20 years from now. That number may sound a little bit scary, but you have to realize that your assets are growing over those 20 years as well to fund for those payments also. So it's more of, you know, just a mindset of we know we're going to have more benefit payments to be made 20 years out in the future, but we're funding for that as well. So it's not, none of this is changing what your current funding policy would be or anything along those lines. Page nine, just the historical funded status of the plan. We talked about we used the blue line, the actuarial basis. to help smooth out some of the volatility. That volatility you see in 2008 through 2012, where the market value was really much less than the actuarial value. So during that period of time, the city's contribution could have been much greater if we've been doing it strictly on a market value basis. We helped mitigate some of that, allowed for that period of time for the market value to catch back up to the actuarial value of assets, which it did in about 2014, and they've been pretty consistent and pretty much on top of each other since that period of time. So that's the good thing about using a smoothing value when you're doing contributions, is you don't get that you don't get that huge swing in contributions that a city definitely wouldn't want to look at and have to fathom in 1 year. And then to Dave's point from earlier on page 10, is the funded ratio of the plan and what its health is. Here's kind of historically where the firefighters have been over the past 7 years versus what the Florida public safety plans have been. So this is information that Department of Management Services prints out. I just looked at all the Florida public safety plans that were in the database and what their funded percentage is. Once again, to Dave's point, these could be all types of funding, all types of funded percentages being used. So you're using 7.5, you were using 7.75. These could be a mixture of 7, 7.5, 7.75, 8. It could be all over the board. I didn't look specifically at just the ones who had the same discount rate that you had. But I think it's important to note that 2014, 2015, 2016, really most of the public plans in the state of Florida, their funded ratios have been pretty steady. I mean, they've been pretty flat. They haven't really grown. And yours has. And it would have grown even more if you lowered your discount rate. So that took, that took about 3% back off of this number as well.
Right. So it would be around 80 if we were still at 7.
You'd be around 80% if you're still at 7. So we're seeing a growth pattern here.
90. All the 175.
Okay, wait a minute. Say that again.
Is this the number that if we become 90% funded, and according to the contract, Rob, right?
Right.
This is the number we're looking at here to get to 90. To change.
I don't know.
175 money.
Yeah. Yes.
That's the number.
Yeah. This would be that number. So once that gets to 90, and it won't happen. It's not going to happen overnight.
But here's. Back to my earlier question on page 2. Okay, I guess that ain't 77.6, 78% is around
the rounded number. Yeah.
Okay. We have it in our contract that when we get to 90% funded ratio, I don't think it's based in their actuarial value or market value. So that'll be something we have to address when we get close.
Could choose the most advantageous one.
Yes.
Work on that.
All right.
You could, yeah, if you want to get really aggressive, you could say we're going to do it on the GADV basis. And like I said, the market value, as long as they stay pretty much in flux, the market value would have the benefit of the drop and the COLA reserves, which are pretty much at 100% funded. You'd be blending that in with the pension plan being somewhat less. That would help boost it and get it closer to 90%,
right,
on a faster basis. But that is probably at least 5 years out in the future, unless
at least.
Yeah. Well, I have complete confidence that Dave can knock it out of the ballpark with
the return. 0.8. Numbers.
So I think you said he was investing all in Bitcoin. Is that what you were doing? So yeah, the important thing is, you've lowered your discount rate and you're still getting your funded ratio is still progressing up nicely, and the rest of Florida is staying pretty flat. Most of that is probably due to the fact that they haven't been doing anything with their discount rates either during that period of time. Page 11 I added in here just because we have to. it's the state of Florida reporting, and they do require, really, the only one they require is...
The 5.5.
Is the 5.5. So, we always show, well, if you're going to force us to report it 5.5, we always recommend to our clients that on their website, which they're free to do whichever one they want, they have to show the 5.5. We recommend that they also show a 9.5 for, from a historical perspective. What happened after the crash is the 7.5 number. They made us report, that's our assumption rate, and they said, well, what if you don't make your assumption? Because, of course, nobody was making their assumption after the crash. They said, if you don't, we want to see how much it's going to cost if you underperform by 2%. So the state mandated that we report how much it's going to cost taxpayers if at 2%, if our funded, if our assumption rate was 2% less than it is. So, you know, the tax watch, Florida tax watch, and all the right wingers and the conservatives and the you know, hardcore, they wanted to see how much it's going to cost in a worst case scenario. So that's why we have to add that one, that 5.5%. If we don't make our money, how much more it's going to cost the taxpayers. So we're adding that if times are good and we actually make more than we're supposed to make, that's how much less it will cost the city. So that's how that came about.
So if we don't make enough money, this is what it's going to cost, and if we make our mark, that's what it costs, and if we make more, correct, 2% more, so on your order,
yeah,
more or less.
Yeah, yeah. And these are all,
and that's,
you know,
long-term numbers. So the show public can come in and look at these and compare every pension.
They pretty much tried to mimic the what's being done on the private side, because on the private side, they have to do their financial reporting really based on bond rates.
Yeah, fixed income.
On fixed income bond rates. So in the private side, you'll see a lot of their financial reporting. They're reporting at 4.5%, you know, some really, really low number on their pension plans. And so the state of Florida, the legislation, when they were in debate, they originally wanted to use those numbers. They originally said, well, let's report on truly just the bond rates that are out there, knowing that it would be even worse than this. And I think a lot of the plans, a lot of legislation for the Florida plans are kind of like, well, no, you know,
be more realistic.
Let's be more realistic. And I think they actually argued that, well, under GASB, under the accounting requirements, we're already required to report a number that's 100 basis points lower and 100 basis points higher. Why don't we just use those? And I think they kind of negotiated a midpoint here, kind of saying, well, we'll require you for 200 basis points lower. But it's a pretty, most of these numbers are pretty meaningless, other than the fact that the state of Florida gets to report them all on its website, and who knows what reporter or analyst might go out there and grab all the stuff and say, well, boy, look at how poorly funded all these plans are at 5.5%. Well, it's kind of a meaningless number. Most of these numbers are very, very meaningless on here. Even the years that assets are expected to support benefit payments, you know, some people might get really, really worried looking at those numbers going, well, you know, if I look at 5.5% here, the assets are only going to last 17 years. If I'm a new firefighter, I'm not even going to retire for 20 years, so the plan's going to be, there's going to be no assets in the plan? Well, that 17-year number has to be figured out assuming there's no future contributions being made into the plan. It's just taking current assets and running them out with benefit payments. So it's a completely meaningless number, too. So I report it here. You can tell from the disdain in my voice and most actuaries, we don't like reporting these numbers, which is one of the reasons that we report the higher number as well.
Right.
Of saying it's just, you know, we have to report it. We're sorry, we have to report it. But it's important for y'all to know where these numbers kind of come from when people question them. On to some good news, your COLA. That's probably the better news. You started in 2016. We developed a COLA table for you. Designed much like the one we designed for Miami firefighters in terms of how it operates. It's a table that pretty much you're always guaranteed to get a benefit increase as you move across the table. And that's even if we don't adjust the table at all. So if we adjust the table upwards, it's even better news for you as you go across and get increases. It's got a funding source to it. We've built some conservatism into it to make sure that the benefits will, or the money will always be there for the future. Some of those things we do is we don't even look at, we don't even look at 20% of the assets. We just reserve that and kind of take it out of the mixture and say we're going to base this table on everything except 20% of the assets. And so in case times go bad, we dip into that 20% reserve to maintain the table, but Miami's never had to reduce their table because of that. They've always had, and they've had to dip in their reserve to do it, but they've always been able to maintain the table where it's at. So that's one of the conservatism. We're using a 7% discount rate in here as well, so that's another layer of conservatism into the mix. And we also have a load for future actives. We know that, you know, it's a vibrant population. You have people coming into the plan, people leaving the plan. So we also assume that there's going to be some additional liability from people that are coming into the plan in the future. So we pack all that into the calculation to do that. And even with that, with the COLA table, started out at 564. We call it a 564 table because the table is developed off of creating benefit at a point in time, and then the entire other table is developed from that, really just based on ratios. So as that node changes, the entire benefit table changes and increases. So it started at 564, went to 593, 2018, we think it can go up to 666. Hopefully there's no super religious people here who are worried about a 666 table, just so happen to end up working out that way. And really, if you look at this page here, it kind of is an evidence of really how these benefits are growing. I think it's a pretty good example of how a person's monthly benefit from this changes. So if you look at the blue circles on the first page, since it started in 2016, we're only counting retirement since that point in time. So a person that worked 25 years in the system and has been in the plan, they've been getting $95 a month through this COLA benefit. It was expected. If nothing else had changed, their benefit would have gone up to $119 a month. So a pretty nice bump in pay, a pay over that 1 year period. With the change in the table, it actually goes to $133. So their monthly benefit from the COLA went from $95 last year up to $133 this year. So they're getting a nice benefit. It grows pretty large this way earlier on. Ultimately, it'll go up about at least 4% a year. So people can expect that their COLA benefit will go up 4% a year, really, if nothing changes. And even more than 4% early on in their career or early on in their retirement. So it is a great benefit to have. It really does help boost up and supplement their additional benefit they're getting out of the pension plan.
That's what we fought for a lot of years. We waited for a lot of years. And finally, we got it. I just wish we would have gotten all the 175 money instead of half of it.
Page 13 is just a rundown of your participant information.
Is there an extra one with the purple button?
So you can see your retirees and beneficiaries have been going up, your drop participants. They kind of fluctuate up and down depending on where people are in their drop plan status. Your active participants, been staying very, very steady. The city knows, or at least they think they know how many firefighters they need. They've been keeping it fairly consistent over the period of time. And the number of people that are disabled, it didn't change, hadn't changed in a few years.
Does adding firefighters increase the liability, or is it?
Adding firefighters will increase the liability because they're in the plan earning benefits. It may, in the early years, decrease the cost because they're probably, since they're contributing the same amount as firefighters that are near retirement, they're probably actually overpaying for their benefit, what the cost of their benefit is early on, because we know their benefit's not going to get paid for, we're not expecting it to get paid for 20 or 25 years out in the future. So they're probably slightly overfunding or overpaying their position early on in their career. They're vastly underpaying it later on in their career, but that's generally how it would work. So they would. So sometimes there's not a whole lot of cost for those people early on in their career into the plan. But adding people into the plan will increase the liability slightly. It'll actually decrease the cost as a percentage of payroll because you've got a lot of extra pay into the system and not a whole lot of benefits yet attributed to that pay into the system. So oftentimes the cost, if you add a lot of people in the system, the cost on a percentage of payroll basis will drop.
So hiring a batch of people would be more harmful to the plan than hiring people like steady over years?
Yes, generally. Sometimes you have to, though. Right.
We just opened a new station, so I assume that in the near future they're probably going to go up about 10.
Okay.
10 employees or so to man an engine at that station. Right now, they're taking an engine from another station.
To try to manage it.
It's going to be temporary, though. I think eventually they're going to increase by 10, 12 people in the next year.
Yeah. Well, with that, the overall dollar cost will go up.
Right.
The percentage of payroll will probably drop.
Right.
Because you'll have a lot more payroll in the system, which will more than counterbalance the increase in the cost,
right,
at least early on.
Okay.
And then finally, can't vote on it today for consideration. We do experience studies for plans. We haven't done one of these in 7 years. The last one we did was for a 7-year period ending in 2010. So the next 7-year period really would be up through the fiscal year that just ended, where we would look at all the demographic and economic assumptions that are being used to value this plan, make sure they're still reasonable, recommend any adjustments to them that we feel might be necessary or recommended, and how that might impact the liability and the cost up or down. But just good practice to get them done. Larger plans, probably do them every 3 to 5 years. A plan this size can wait a little bit longer to do it, but 7 years is probably a far enough period of time where it probably needs to be looked at again. So something the board should consider having us do. And I guess in your May meeting, you can possibly formally approve for us to do that.
Now, you would do that with the upcoming next actuarial report?
What we would do is we would do the study on that year's data. We would make recommendations to be implemented probably for the 10/1/2018 valuation. Yeah, so any changes to the assumptions that we recommend and that got approved, we would like to see starting for the 10/1/18 valuation, but board's discretion, they can say, well, let's wait an additional year and implement them 10/1/2019.
Okay, so is what you're recommending that you do it off of this current actuarial report or the upcoming?
We would do it off of
fiscal year.
We would do it off of all the data that happened between 2010 and 2017. So
okay.
Through the most recent valuation data that we have.
All right.
And then use those to make our recommendations for assumptions going out, that changes could be made at really any point in time.
Okay.
This wouldn't capture the new contract.
He says that that wouldn't capture this new contract, so maybe it might be better to wait until this will be.
In terms of the pays and things like that? Well, I think it'd probably be good to see how the pays, see how our assumptions have matched those pays for the past 7 years, and that any recommendations we would make would be in conjunction with what the negotiation was to be sure that, yeah, to be sure that we're not being overly aggressive or conservative in those assumptions compared to what we already will know is going to happen.
And that's not only the 1 year of the new contract anyway.
You know, if we waited until the end of this year,
3 year.
I'm sorry.
You know the path for 3
yeah,
years.
Yeah, yeah. Which means he can project.
Yeah, he could have that information.
Right.
Yeah, so we would, based on that, we could even take your current membership and say, okay, well, here's the path we expect most people to kind of be on. What does that come up with as kind of a payroll growth assumption?
Now, would you do that and present it next February, or would you come, or would you do that
at
the quarterly meetings?
We would probably, let's see, probably have a,
we have
a May, like an August meeting. We would probably like to do that this summer and then present that in the August meeting. That way the decision can be made to go ahead and implement it for the 10-1-18 valuation.
Okay. What I think we're probably going to do is have another meeting like in a week or two when I know we can get a quorum and go ahead and we have to pass all this stuff. And at our November meeting, we weren't able, not because of a lack of a quorum, but because of lack of posting. It's got to be posted X amount of within reasonable time, and the girl who does all the posting was out sick for a while, so it didn't get posted, so we couldn't take any meeting, any action at that meeting. And here again, we have the same issue. So we can't push this on another quarter. We're going to have a special meeting to get caught up on all of this nonsense. Okay. So, and at that time, maybe we'll go ahead and approve the actuary to go ahead and do the experience study. And the city wants it done. I know the other two plans have already done their experience study. They prefer it. I'm not speaking for them, but I'm pretty sure they prefer it on like a 5-year basis.
So we're 7 years out, basically.
We're 7 years.
7 years out. The last one we did was in 2010. So we would gather that 7 years of data and see how that and see how everything works out. And we would get with Dave as well and get their thoughts and recommendations about what the future looks like in terms of asset performance.
Okay. So did you want to go over, so are you, you're finished with the summary?
Yes, the final page is just as actuaries. We feel we have to put the stuff in here about what plan provisions and the assumptions and methods that were being used to evaluate it. And our profession sometimes gets mad at us if we don't include it, but I don't intend to ever go over it.
Okay. And did you want to go over anything in the actual report?
No, like I said, it's it was pretty much summarized there. You know, you can see towards the back of the reports of all the amortization bases that are set up and how they're getting amortized.
Right.
That would be on page. I guess the important pages to kind of look at would be page 32. That just shows kind of the history of payroll growth and expected salary growth. And page 27 is the one with all of your unfunded liabilities and how much time is left on each of them and how much are being paid off on each of them on a yearly basis.
Yeah, 32 and 37. Okay. Does anyone else have any questions for the actuaries? Well, David, thank you for going in detail as much and for educating everybody. It was in a very easy to understand way.
And if anybody ever has any questions, feel free to reach out to me. I'd be happy to answer any questions they all may have.
So, because everybody always asks me that, well, what percentage? I tell them it's not a percentage, you know, it just goes up.
It just goes up. Actually, in the early years, well, I mean, from year one to year two, it goes up 100%, okay. You know, and then it generally decreases. Once you get out to 25 years, it's more, it's 4%. The whole table is set up on a 4% growth.
Okay.
But just the way the table works, you go from 1 year to 2 years, that's 100%, 2 years to 3 years, 50%. So you see huge growth earlier on in the benefit.
Okay, so they get big increase early and then eventually.
Eventually it's about a 4%, right? Yeah.
Okay, that's, yeah, everybody. And that's 4% of the, not 4% of their benefit, but 4% of their COLA benefit.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah, that's an important distinction to make. It's not 4% of their benefit.
Would be nice. But sounds great. Okay. All right. Well, we can't approve it, so we'll schedule another meeting to go ahead and do that. If nobody has anything else for David Harris, then I will turn the floor over to David West. And the quarterly report, performance report.
All right, so before we get into the book, actually, I'm in the book. But the very first page of the book is a letter from my former partner, but currently my my president and CEO, Mike Welker. And every year we try to give everybody an update on the firm. Status, and as I've communicated before, we've got a program in place that we try to give worthy individuals the opportunity to get a piece of the firm with equity ownership. And this year, we announced one new partner only, and that was Dan Johnson. You guys might know him from FDPTA. And so Dan will be a what I call a soft equity partner. We have hard equity where you're filing K-1s and you got to register and everything. And then we have soft equity partners, which are equally significant in that they participate in the profit sharing of the firm. So glad Dan's a great guy. Glad he was he received that. The right hand side of the paragraph kind of memorializes what I was discussing with you guys, kind of giving me the inside scoop first before it happened, and that was that I had recycled my ownership back to the firm. So now I am a regular W-2 employee and not filing taxes.
Guaranteed paycheck, huh?
Yeah, well. I'm not filing taxes in seven states anymore, my accounting life anyway got much simpler. But I'm grateful for the opportunity to be associated with such a financially strong firm, so that I do have the opportunity to cash out. So my equities, along with, as you're obviously already aware, Joe Boggan's equity, are back in the firm, and that's what
Joe sold out. Joe sold out too.
Yeah, Joe sold out, I guess it's been 2.5 years now, maybe even three, actually, since Joe moved his ownership. So for me, it's a win-win because I get to focus exclusively on servicing clients, and that's what I want to do. My idea of management is this is your job, go do it, and that doesn't cut it. So
it's similar in our profession. It's like people say, well, why don't you want to be chief? And it's like, No. 10 times more work, a little bit more money. You know, it's like, no, not interested, no thank you, forget it.
Yep.
You so, can have this, what do you call, recognition and everything else, just let me go in, do my job at my little substation, and when I go home, I'm home, and I'm not worried about all the problems.
Yep, exactly.
Yeah.
So, you know, for I consider it a win-win. So I'll be staying on, you know, really indefinitely with an open-ended employment agreement. And as long as you guys will have me, it's my intention to...
did you guys buy that building you're in? Or did you do a long-term lease?
No. We're going to be out of that building. And we are actually... we're going to be done with basically a building rehab that we are purchasing, and it's going to be in Winter Park.
Okay.
So we are moving our offices, hopefully, if everything goes on schedule, October, November of this year. So we'll be out of the that office space. Yeah. So the people that are managing the firm now on page 3, the management, as I said, Mike remains present CEO. He's still the majority owner. And so our hard equity owners now are Brian, Troy, and Steve Gordon. And, you know, I'm pleased to say I'm backed by, you know, very strong group of people here as a field consultant now. So if you look down at consultants in our management team, we've got Jack and Dan have accepted director positions. So they'll be actually be migrating off relationships and back into the office, assuming you know, as they have been their management responsibilities. Thing I get excited about is if you look at the bottom line, we're 87 employees now, but we continue to emphasize advanced degrees, and if you look at, yeah, I think we might have the highest ratio of charter financial analyst holders, CFA, designation holders, to in relation to the number of professional employees. We also have six, and that's the alternative analyst certification that you can get. That's like another focus level. And three SIPM, those are the folks that put the book together. And that's a whole nother level of certification. So main point here, you know, we continue to reinvest in the firm, and we've been able to retain a lot of really good people. I think we're up to $68 billion or so in assets under management, with you know, offices now scattered around the country. So everything is, continues to go you know, very well for the firm. So that's my update. So we can talk about page 4, but you know, up until recently, I was going to say this book is irrelevant because of what transpired in February. So to be efficient, let me just put the past with the projection. And I think with the February market correction, we have to ask ourselves, what is different in February than was in January? And the short answer is, you know, nothing. U.S. fundamentals, economic growth continues to be, you know, pretty respectful. Now we're around 3-ish% GDP. Our European counterparts are actually growing at a faster rate of growth now than we are in the U.S. So that whole, you know, ship has turned and is gaining positive momentum. If we look at the U.S. employment situation, it's very good. We're at the point now where we should start to see some wage increases from pressures coming from, you know, the full employment. And then an indicator that is a favorite of mine over the last 30 plus years is looking what do bond investors feel as far as the health and well-being of corporate America, and right now, and that gauge would be
you know, how much, you and I are, we're lenders to corporate America through this pension fund, right? When we purchase bonds, essentially lending Ford or whoever money for their operations, and in return, we're getting an interest rate. So right now, that interest rate or coupon is very, very low relative to what we could be earning if we weren't taking any risk and we're just owning treasury. So we like to call that the credit spread. So right now, the credit spread is extremely low, almost historically low, which means that we as investors are perfectly comfortable with what's going on with the balance sheets of corporate America. Once we start to get uncomfortable, that spread is going to creep up because we're going to demand a higher return back. So it's typically, it's been a great indicator. You don't know when, but it's a great indicator of, you know, things are changing and something might happen down the road. And if you remember in 2008, when the market crashed, credit spreads blew out. So, you know, no one would lend anybody any money, obviously. But, you know, it moves commensurate with how comfortable people are with the economy. So really nothing's changed. So as we were joking around before the meeting, I think the only thing, the only event was more behavioral finance related, and that was that the market was arguably overbought. It's hard to say it's overvalued because that's an ongoing debate when you're in a bull market. There was an enormous flow of money into U.S. equities, and then of course we had the, we had the implosion with the VIX contract that clearly had a significant impact, near-term impact, in creating that flash crash. So if we fast forward where we are, January was an obscenely euphoric month for investments. If we look at the equity markets now, we crashed, we came back, so now we're up right around 2%
from calendar year to date. So we've made up all of that crash.
Well, we had a lot of growth in that first month that we just kind of lost.
Okay.
So we're up big for the year.
Yeah, I mean, January, which I think the market was up, what, 6.5%, 7%?
A little over 7%.
Yeah, that's great.
Okay, but we're still up 2% since January.
Yeah, so equities collectively are up 2% calendar year to date, right? So that means arguably this report is still valid. We'll hang on to all the gains that we're going to talk about today. One exception may be in bonds because interest rates have continued to go up. So as rates go up, bond prices go down. So we're probably grinding out negative total return right now for this quarter. So equities have recovered, but to the extent we're in investment-grade bonds, and the picture's not looking quite so pretty. But we have other investments going on here to help offset that. So for December, quick and dirty, best place to be was emerging markets, up 7.4. Developed country markets up 4.2. At home, flag blue, S&P 500 was up 6.6. And in the green shaded area, if you look at the Bloomberg Barclays U.S. Ag, there was just enough coupon to offset what at that time was just the beginning of interest rates starting to creep up. So with that as the backdrop, let's zero in straight on the bottom line and jump up to page 20. And we had a great start to the year. The total fund was up 4.11% on a year-over-year basis. If you want to make comparisons to corporate America, we were up 15.4%. The three-year number annualizes at 8.45, and the five-year number annualizes at 9.88, and again, that's for periods end of December. Number in parentheses, as you know, is the peer group ranking relative to the other public fund systems out there. And so for the year, we at 15.4, we actually came in about average. But the three-year number, we're in the top 12th percentile, and the five-year number, we're top 21st percentile. And, you know, we're, most of the time now, since a lot, vast majority of the portfolio is passively managed, we're going to be right around the benchmark. And so for the year, you know, we missed it by a couple basis points, 14 basis points. Three-year a little bit ahead, and five-year, you know, pretty close to even there. So it's just an observation. If you look at the total fund policy, this is the asset allocation that we're driving, and it's dollar-weighted to the appropriate index that represents those investments. So just to reinforce the point, it's the asset allocation decision that is really the primary determinant of your returns. So if you look at the three-year number, our asset allocation itself at 8.10% finished in the top 20th percentile. So it's really what we're doing with asset allocation, not necessarily with active managers outperforming or underperforming, you know, that puts you where you're going to be with the peer group. And five-year, you know, 27th percentile. So any questions on those top line numbers? So quickly then, just running down page 20, our one active domestic equity manager, and it's a broad cap value manager. They outperformed for the quarter, so that put them a little closer to even on the year, 12.3 versus 13.9, just trailing marginally on the 3 year and ahead marginally on the 5 year. Wells Fargo Large Cap Value, that's an index fund. So value stocks collectively for the quarter were up 5.2. Clearly all the action has been in growth stocks. The Wells Fargo Growth Index Fund was up 7.8%. And look at that 30% gain year over year coming out of growth stocks. And the Small Cap Value Index was up 16.2. And we jump down to page 21. We do have active management in our foreign equity. We've got it split between index and Euro-Pacific fund. Euro-Pacific fund was up a little light on the quarter, but fiscal year, calendar year, 31.17 versus 27.7. So nice outperformance coming from that fund. Jumping into our bond portfolio.
Let's go back up to small cap. I'm looking at that, and I'm now the Vanguard. Is that what is the Vanguard? What does Vanguard use as their index? I don't believe they use the MSCI small cap.
Yeah, 1750. Correct. They've changed indexes, so. It would probably be appropriate for us to...
Can we put both in there?
Change that,
not,
yeah.
Not change it, but put both in there just so we can see what the normal... I mean, because that's... The average is the MSCI. That's what the... What do you call the world uses. So let's see how we compare to their benchmark as well as what we would be if we were in any other index.
Yeah, and I think your point, the problem is that Vanguard is kind of effectively creating their own indexes.
Okay.
But,
so there,
you know, we should be defaulting to the Vanguard indexes. But the more commonplace
is
index is going to be something like the MSCI. So we'll put in there, we'll put both in there. But you're going to know that the fund is going to effectively net a fee, you know, be tracking the Vanguard, Vanguard index. Yeah. Yeah, we'll make that change. So back to page 21, we do have a small allocation to the Vanguard Inflation Protection Securities Fund. The TIPS actually outperformed investment grade bonds for this period of time. You know, people are starting to think inflation is going to come back. So this is kind of a late cycle defensive play. We have a core position set in here, and we'll slowly add to that over time as the cycle matures here. We already talked about how bonds did, in this case, Integrity is an active bond manager. You know, we have to go out for 3 years. for us to see a positive result. We got 50 basis points squeak or so, half a percent or so squeaked out from the integrity portfolio. Shifting to the diversification effort, our remaining global bond fund is the PIMCO Diversified Income Fund. And look at that 1 year return, 589 versus 889 coming out of the fund, outperforming all periods, you know, 1% peer group rank. They were a huge beneficiary of everybody bidding up low quality bonds, and that as spreads came down, interest rates came down, right, they captured the increase in the bond prices strategically. So that fund did very well. And then shifting over to page 22, we parked quite a bit of our investment grade bond money over here. And we have three real estate managers. So we have our largest mega property manager is UBS. Very extremely conservative, very limited use of leverage. They actually had a pretty strong quarter, 2.35. That's higher than usual. So year over year, they're annualizing right around 6.29%. Our other conservative core manager, but in more smaller property types, was American Core Realty, and they've annualized right around 8%. And our more aggressive manager that does some value add and property, you know, refits and reassignments would be Intercontinental, and they came in annualizing at 8.68% for the fiscal year. So I think in order of conservative to aggressive, the return results are also properly reflective of the type of risk that the portfolios are taking. And we talked about it before, you know, we need to temper. Obviously, our expectations for real estate is probably going to be coming in around the 7-ish% annualized going forward. But still better than bonds, so we want to stay allocated in this area. Crescent, the middle market debt manager, you know, we haven't had a capital call for that one yet. And so hopefully the end of this quarter, we'll start to be able to put some money to work there. All the administrative functions we'll need to re-coordinate the authorized signers and everything for all that. So we'll need guidance.
Yeah, we were looking to discuss it at this meeting, but
we'll need guidance on that one. So yeah, if you can keep me in the loop on that one.
Okay.
Because we will have stuff coming up and we want to be responsive. So.
Right.
So any questions on the percentage return? All right, let's do cash flow. And you know, back up to page 19. And we had discussed potentially moving the contribution to the PIMCO Diversified Income Fund, which is so overweight in equities, but we ended up with all the outflows. We ended up with no real extra money to put to work. So the only cash flows actually came, if you look at the net transfer line, we actually had to raise a little money. So we pulled that from the Integrity core bond portfolio. But if you follow with me on the bottom line there, total fund, we started the year with $57,707,939. Our contributions, member city contributions, $816,894. Distributions for benefit payments were $1,124,000. Our management fees as invoiced and paid by the custodian, and that's pretty much only going to be the real estate managers and the Dalton. Apparently Dalton didn't send us an invoice during this period, or at least one didn't get paid. But those fees totaled $22,089. Other expenses for plan operations were $6,648. And then we break investment earnings into income, where we earned $576,223. And the appreciation, very nice, $1,791,833. So what, right around 2.25 million or so net of fees was earned during the quarter, and that left us with $59,784,152. Any questions on capital? And we can't vote on anything, but just go to page 14. And this is the asset allocation where we are. I think some of the 4.7 over target has obviously that's corrected a little bit. So we're not quite as overweight, but we remain overweight there and underweight appropriately in domestic fixed income and overweight appropriately by almost 3% in real estate. Going forward, I'm going to recommend that we overemphasize international equities as opposed to U.S. equities. So as we rebalance going forward, you know, we'll look to putting, you know, adjusting that ratio a little bit. I'm not sure we want to do anything right now, given what's transpired in the marketplace, but I would expect future recommendations would be to, you know, as we add to equity, let's at least maintain an overweight in international equity. So I didn't have any action items anyway to vote on, other than, you know, waiting for the Crescent capital call. So as Crescent comes in, given the current allocation and still material overweight to domestic equities, I think we're going to have to fund that with from equities.
Okay. How far out of the, where are the parameters being off of our target allocation? As far as just with the fixed income side, with us being so underweighted there.
Yeah.
Is so there a downside that we can't go past?
Yeah, so on fixed income,
I think it's,
let's see, global. So domestic fixed income, we've got a target of 25. And I'm going to check policy. I think we're still within the parameters there because I think we had a little more. We didn't do that one to the 5% rule because that's obviously the what the collection allocation. That I think we're still above minimum allocation to fixed.
No, I agree that that's not the place to be. I just wanted to make sure that we're
within our
bracket. And actually, we may end up with the opportunity to start to rebalance there. If, I mean, given the current direction, as you're well aware of interest rates, I mean, we're at the 10-year is at, I was just checking this morning, 10-year is at 287. So we're almost at 3%. And that's a significant move in a very short period of time.
And they said that Yellen's replacement is planning on kicking up the interest rates at the next, throughout, I forget how much, one during this calendar year she's planning on kicking up, or he's planning on kicking it up. I don't know whether that's going to happen or not.
You're right. All indications are that, you know, they plan to stay on the same course, same trajectory. So. So that's my report. Fortunately for me, no actions required in the voter approval.
Anybody have any questions on the quarterly report? Okay. Well, you have any questions? Okay. All right, then we will go on to do what we can do anyway. So minutes approval will have to be tabled. Council payable will have to be tabled. Other matters. Mr. Osner, please. I'm going to read a letter from Bob Klausner, our pension attorney, Adam Levinson, and the whole firm. For the past several years, our firm has faced increased expenses in all areas of our operation. We have avoided passing these increased costs to our clients by economizing in ways not affecting our quality of service or our ability to respond to your needs. At this time, we must make an adjustment to our fees. Beginning January 2018, your new rate will be $350 per hour. Please note that our fees have not increased in over 8 years. Test is in an agreement for legal services which provides for the new fees. Please have the agreement placed on the next meeting agenda for consideration. We greatly appreciate your business and the opportunity to continue serving you. If you have questions regarding this increase, please contact me. Do you know what Lee charges?
Lee is up to $475 an hour.
Okay. The pension attorney for the other two plans charges $475 an hour. And
he requires that he attends all meetings?
Yeah. So he attends, so they have to pay for him to drive here and then pay for him to sit through their meeting. It's nice to have an attorney, but not necessary. I've been doing this for 19 years, and I've had the attorney show up to, I think, two meetings. So I think this is very reasonable. But anyways, that we can't do anything on it anyways. And not only does he charge $475, but she has to call him 15 times to get one answer. I shouldn't say that on tape, but he's very unresponsive to his clients. You know, because you work with Lee and some of your clients. And,
yeah.
But he's in all, he's a great attorney. I like, Lee's a great guy, but he's had some health issues. Significant health issues.
Yeah,
so he's downsizing his firm. You know, he's told a lot of his clients that they need to find another attorney, and he's only keeping a handful, you know, I think good on his part. He's realizing he's in over his head. He can't handle as many clients as he's done. So, anyways, that's it. Drop, we can't do that. The fifth member is appointed. Now, I've had conversations with our attorney on the fifth member. The board doesn't have to re-vote on you every 2 years, but as a ministerial act, City Council does have to, reappoint you on every 2 years. But you're in basically as long as you want to stay in, and you, unless we four members choose to put somebody else in, then you're in until you don't want to be in anymore. So, yeah. That will go to council, and council will go ahead and do it as a ministerial act and reappoint him. Okay, while we're here, we can discuss this. We won't do anything, but in my absence, permanent absence, somebody's going to have to step up to chair. I don't know if Scott wants to do it, if you're interested in doing it, or whoever wants to do it. Scott, are you interested in doing it, or?
I'm interested in doing it, yes.
You're the current secretary.
Right. It would be appropriate for somebody who's been on the board to step up, but I mean, they actually have to show up to the meeting. So.
Jim Williams,
I know.
As far as I'm concerned, you know, he's done.
I feel comfortable.
This is the last straw, and we've got other guys that are showing.
I'm willing to do it and learn. I'm also willing to support Justin if he wants to do it. Wherever I am needed, I will try to fill those shoes as best I can.
Okay. And as I was talking to Dave, Scott. You know, the reason I got him is because he served on the board back before he had kids and got busy in life. So Now his kids are grown, and he has more time.
Yeah, and divorced. His kids are driving, so.
So he has more time, and he has the experience, and he's been to several schools, so I thought it better than, and we had this discussion with Josh, you know, Josh was going to step up, but because he has the knowledge and the experience that he'll step up, but it's going to be more or less on an interim basis, because he only has about three-ish years left. So then we're going to get Josh up to speed, and if Rob wants to continue on.
Trying to develop lines of succession.
Yeah. I tried with other people, but they quit.
Very smart to do so. I mean, that's, I know the Miami FIPO, they've got a great series of progression and transition that they got set up, and it's been working really well for a decade, over decades now, so.
Yeah. Okay.
Administratively, it's kind of easier to have a employee as the chair for signatures and things like that also.
I said, if I need to sign something, I can just come down here and sign it, and Justin lives far away. He said, on this side of the county border,
I am in the county.
stretch the line to encapsulate him.
Yeah, if he walks out and walks 100 yards, he's out of the county. So it's a long drive for him to come into town. So anyways, that'll be at our next, and authorized signatures will be at the same time.
Yeah, I don't know if this is the appropriate time or not, but it has been an honor and a privilege to work for you as steward of this system. And if I only hope that your membership has a remote idea of how well you have guided this board to make sure that this benefit stays. So,
thank you,
an honor working for you.
I appreciate that.
Yeah, I will second those sentiments, and even pass those sentiments along from Randy's family as well. I'm sure we'll share the exact same thoughts of the amount of work you put into making sure this benefit and this fund remains active, vibrant, and available for its membership.
Okay. Thank you, David. I appreciate it. Yeah, the rest of this is expenses can't be done, budget can't be done, meeting dates and FPPPTA can't be done. Now, the meeting dates. We have tentatively May 21st as our next meeting date, as our next quarterly meeting, August 20th. 2018 as the following that would be the second quarter calendar year quarterly report, and then November we do not have a date. So
November 12th is Veterans Day observation, and that's generally when we have our meeting, and then the 19th is the week of Thanksgiving.
Okay, the 12th is what now?
Is Veterans Day.
Veterans.
So, the city won't be open.
Right.
You want to schedule something closer?
I didn't know how early you would want to. November, you know, we could do later that week or
Friday. Well, I mean, I guess I was asking if you want to put off setting the meeting?
Yeah, I mean, we can do that too.
Yeah.
Just a thought.
But just look at some dates for you, Dave. Did you write those dates? Because maybe you can do the experience study on
sometime in November.
I was thinking we'd hopefully be able to have it done and accomplished and present on the August 20th meeting.
Okay.
The general board's not meeting. The general police are not meeting until December 10th. That was the next one. We did it. We get everybody together. So.
All right. Well, Dave, look at your.
I'm gonna look at mine. It's not gonna do it.
Yeah, So it's really what your schedule is, Dave.
Wasn't seeing any of those partnership commitments, yeah, I'd be wide open.
I'll keep it on my mind.
Maybe the 13th is the day after Veterans Day.
I'm at 3 meetings on that day. Is Monday okay?
Monday the 12th?
I can do Monday the 12th.
That's Veterans Day.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Or perhaps the previous Monday, Monday the 5th, November the 5th, could you have the report done? That's just 5 weeks after quarter end.
Yeah, Monday the 5th would work. We can get everything out.
You can have the report done and everything ready by November the 5th, because remember, it's October 30th, that's the end of the quarter. That's no problem getting a quarterly report done.
Yeah, we should be able to get that. It might be a preliminary report, but it will be meaningful.
Okay, let's go ahead and schedule that. It can always be changed if it needs to be changed at a later date. I'll write it in my calendar. I might be in.
So November 5 at 9 a.m. again?
Yeah. And Alicia, you want to go ahead and reserve the room for that day?
9 a.m.
Wait, say that again.
9 a.m.
Yeah. They're always 9 a.m. Okay. All right. Does anyone else have anything for anybody they would like to bring up at this point?
How does the transition happen? You leave employment?
Yes.
Do you have to officially resign from the board? Yes. Is there nominations that have to happen? And then if so, there's multiple nominations and then obviously an election?
Yes. And I will get with the attorney, I will get with Alicia, and we will come up with a plan on that. And there's filings, the filings you have to do with the state.
Yeah, there's a form that's allowed.
The form, the financial disclosure form.
Yeah, so I thought one for that year, and then one after we fill out. I think it's 30 or 60 days that you're no longer on the board.
Right.
So then you'll have two that year.
I'll just fill them both out at the same time, and I'll be done. And the best thing to do is, I think I told you, you fill out the form the one time, and then each year after that, the only thing, you just take the same information, because it tells you how many houses, what's your source of income, city of Ocala. Your real estate holdings, you can put your address down, but you don't even have to put a value on it, just put your, and then each year I just copy off of last year's thing, so you don't have to come up with a whole bunch of stuff. And
normally they'll send you two or three reminders.
Yeah.
That's good. I need reminders.
You don't do that. Alicia stays on it too, you know.
Yeah, when she can pass June or July, the clerk's office starts emailing me, and then I start emailing you.
Because there's a big fee if you don't do it. There's a, and they're trying to
get out of the day or something. Once I mean, September, start September 1st.
Yeah, it's a big fee if you don't get that done. So, all right then, if nobody else has anything, we will, with no further business for the board. The meeting is adjourned at 11:06.